The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Julie Hepp. I'm here today to introduce one of my favorite authors, Cornelia Funke, who will be talking about what we all have been waiting for, the latest installment of the Inkworld trilogy, Inkdeath. I remember the first time I read Inkheart. It was my second Funke book. The first was Thief Lord. Because I enjoyed Thief Lord so much, I was anxious to read anything else by Miss Funke. I opened Inkheart to the first chapter. Rain fell that night, a fine, whispering rain. Many years later, Maggie had only to close her eyes, and she could hear it. Like tiny fingers tapping on the window pane, I was hooked. I got lost in the ink world. Cornelia's writing drew me in and inspired me. As I finished, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to become a writer. As Maggie says in the last page, writing is a kind of magic, too. Miss Funke creates magic with words in all her books, and that's what I hope to do in my writing. So without further ado, Cornelia Funke.
Thank you so much. That was wonderful.
I think I should have her read. That was very beautiful. I don't know how much I have to tell you about the story of the trilogy. Can I just see the fingers how many of you read the first book? Okay, that's good. Then I will not explain a lot, okay? What I will say is I read the first chapter from the third book and a bit of the second chapter. The second is slightly scary, so all the younger ones who feel like they should cover their ears, please do that, okay? But we thought it's the best choice to start the reading. What shall I say? The third part starts at a point where most of my characters by now have disappeared into a book and live in that world and play their parts in that world, except for one, Eleanor, who is a bookophile and a book eater and passionate about books, so she doesn't understand why they don't let her in. So I will start with the pain of Eleanor. Nothing but a dog and a sheet of paper. Moonlight fell on Eleanor's bathrobe, her nightdress, her bare feet, and the dog lying in front of them. Orpheus's dog. Oh, the way he looked at her with his eternally sad eyes, as if asking himself why, in the name of all the exciting smells in the world, she was sitting in a library in the middle of the night, surrounded by silent books, just staring into space. Why? Said Eleanor into the silence. Because I can't sleep, you stupid animal. But she patted his head all the same. This is what you've come to, Eleanor, she thought, as she hauled herself out of her armchair. Spending your nights talking to a dog. You don't even like dogs, least of all this one, with his heavy breathing that always reminds you of his appalling master. Still, she had kept the dog, in spite of the painful memories he brought back. She'd kept the chair, too, even though the magpie had sat in it. Mortola. How often Eleanor thought she heard the old woman's voice when she went into the quiet library. How often she seemed to see Mortimer and Risa standing among the bookshelves, or Maggie sitting by the window with a book on her lap, face hidden behind her smooth, bright hair. Memories. They were all she had left. No more tangible than the pictures conjured up by books. But what would be left if she lost those memories too? Then she'd be alone again forever, with the silence and the emptiness in her heart, and an ugly dog. Her feet looked so old in the pale moonlight. Moonlight, she thought, wiggling her toes in it. In many stories, moonlight had magical powers. All lies. Her whole head was full of printed lies. She couldn't even look at the moon with eyes unclouded by veils of letters. Couldn't she wipe all those words out of her head and heart and see the world through her own eyes again, at least once? Heavens, Eleanor, what a fabulous mood you're in, she thought, as she made her way over to the glass case, where she kept everything that Orpheus had left behind, apart from his dog. Wallowing in self-pity like that stupid dog rolling over in every puddle. The sheet of paper that lay behind the glass looked like nothing special, just an ordinary piece of lined paper densely written in pale blue ink. Not to be compared with the magnificently illuminated books in the other display cases, even though the tracing of every letter showed how very impressed Orpheus was with himself. I hope the fire elves have burned that self-satisfied smile off his lips, thought Eleanor as she opened the glass case. I hope the men-at-arms have skewered him, or even better, I hope he starved to death in the whaler's wood miserably and very, very slowly. It wasn't the first time she had pictured to herself Orpheus's wretched end in the ink world. These images gave her lonely heart more pleasure than almost anything. The sheet of paper was already yellowing. To add insult to injury, it was cheap stuff. And the words on it really didn't look as though they could have spirited the writer away to another world right before Eleanor's eyes. Three photographs lay beside the sheet of paper, one of Maggie and two of Risa. A photo of her as a child, and another taken only a few months ago with Mortimer beside her, both of them smiling so happily. Hardly a night went by when Eleanor didn't look at those photographs. By now, at least, the tears had stopped running down her cheeks when she did so, but they were still there in her heart. Bitter tears. Her heart was full to the brim with them. A horrible feeling. Lost. Maggie, Risa, Mortimer. Almost 3 months had passed since their disappearance. In fact, Maggie had even been gone a few days longer than her parents. The dog stretched and came trotting drowsily over to her. He pushed his nose into a bathrobe pocket, knowing there were always a few dog biscuits in it for him. Yes, all right, she murmured, shoving one of the smelly little things into his broad muzzle. Where's your master, then? She held the sheet of paper in front of his nose, and the stupid creature sniffed it as if he really could catch Orpheus's scent behind the words on the page. Eleanor stared at the words, shaping them with her lips. In the streets of Umbra. She'd stood here so often, over the last few weeks, surrounded by books that meant nothing to her. Now she was once again alone with them. They didn't speak to her, just as if they knew that she had changed them all on the spot for the three people she had lost. Lost in a book. I will learn how, damn it! Her voice sounded defiant, like a child's. I'll learn how to read them so that they'll swallow me up. Yes! I will! I will! The dog was looking at her as if he believed every word of it, but Eleanor didn't. Not a single one. No, she was no silver tongue. Even if she tried for a dozen years or more, the words wouldn't make music when she spoke them. She'd loved words so much all her life, although they didn't sing for her the way they sang for Maggie or Mortimer or Orpheus. Damn him three times over. The piece of paper shook in her fingers as she started to cry. Here came the tears again. She'd held them back for so long, all the tears in her heart, until it was simply overflowing with them. Eleanor's sobs were so loud that the dog cowered in alarm. How ridiculous that water ran out of your eyes when your heart hurt. Tragic heroines in books tended to be amazingly beautiful. Not a word about swollen eyes or a red nose. Crying always gives me a red nose, thought Eleanor. I expect that's why I'll never be in any book. Eleanor? She spun around, hastily wiping away her tears. Darius stood in the open doorway, wearing the bathrobe that she had given him for his last birthday. It was much too large for him. What is it? She snapped. Where had that handkerchief gone this time? Sniffing, she pulled it from her sleeve and blew her nose. 3 months! They've been gone 3 months now, Darius. Isn't that a good reason to cry? Yes, it is. Don't look at me so pityingly with your owlish eyes. Never mind how many books we buy, she said, with a wide sweep of her arm towards her well-filled shelves. Never mind how many we get at auction, swap, or steal. Not one of them tells me what I want to know. Thousands of pages, and not a word on any of them with news of the only people I want to know about. Why would I be interested in anything else? Theirs is the only story I want to hear. How is Maggie now? Do you think? How are Risa and Mortimer? Are they happy, Darius? Are they still alive? Will I ever see them again? Jairus looked along the books, as if the answer might after all be found in one of them. But then, like all those printed pages, he gave her no answer. I'll make you some hot milk and honey, he said at last, disappearing into the kitchen. And Eleanor was alone again, with the books, the moonlight, and Orpheus's ugly dog. Only a village. Let's go into the book. The fairies were already beginning to dance among the trees. Swarms of tiny blue bodies. Their wings caught the starlight, and Mo saw the black prince glancing anxiously at the sky. It was still as dark as the surrounding hills, but the fairies were never wrong. On a cold night like this, only the coming of dawn could lure them from their nests, and the village whose harvest the robbers were trying to save this time lay dangerously close to Umbra. As soon as daybreak came, they must be gone. A village like many others, only a dozen poor huts, a few barren stony fields, and a wall that would hardly keep out a child, let alone a soldier. 30 women without their menfolk, 3 dozen fatherless children. 2 days ago, the new governor's men had carried off almost the entire harvest of the neighboring village. The robbers had reached the place too late, but something could still be salvaged here. They'd spent hours digging, showing the women how to hide livestock and provisions underground. The strong man was carrying the last hastily dug sackful of potatoes, his rough-hewn face red with effort. It turned the same color when he was fighting or drunk. Between them all, they lowered the sack into the hiding place they had made just beyond the fields, and Mo covered the entrance with a network of twigs to hide the storage pit from soldiers and tax gatherers. By now, toads were croaking in the surrounding hills, as if to entice out the day, and the men on watch among the huts were getting restless. They'd seen the fairies, too. High time to get away. Back into the forest, where a hiding place could always be found, even though the new governor was sending more and more patrols out to the hills. The milksop, the widows of Umbra called him. A good nickname for the Adderhead's puny brother-in-law, but the milksop's greed for what few possessions his new subjects had was insatiable. Mo rubbed his eyes. Heavens, he was tired. He'd hardly slept for days. There were just too many villages that they might yet be able to reach ahead of the soldiers. You look worn out, Risa had said only yesterday, when she woke up beside him, unaware that he hadn't come to bed beside her until the first light of dawn. He had said something about bad dreams, told her he'd been passing the sleepless hours by working on the book he was binding, a collection of her drawings of fairies and glassmen. He hoped Risa and Maggie would be asleep again, now when he came back to the lonely farmhouse that the Black Prince had found for them. It was east of Umbra, an hour's journey from the city on foot, and far from the land where the Adderhead still ruled, made immortal by a book that Mo had bound with his own hands. A girl hesitantly approached Mo. How old would she be? 6? 7? Her hair was as blonde as his daughter's, but it was a long time since Maggie had been so small. Shyly, she stopped a pace away from him. Snapper emerged from the darkness and went over to the child. Yes, go on, take a good look, he whispered to the little girl. That's really him, the blue jay. He eats children like you for supper. Snapper loved such jokes. Mo bit back the words on the tip of his tongue. Don't believe a word he says, he told her in a low voice. Why aren't you asleep like everyone else? The child looked at him. Then she pushed up his sleeve with her small hands until the scar showed, the scar of which the songs told tales. She looked at him, wide-eyed, with the same mixture of awe and fear he had now seen in so many faces. The blue jay. The girl ran back to her mother, and Mo straightened up. Whenever his chest hurt, where Mottola had wounded him. He felt as if the blue jay, the robber to whom Fenoglio had given most face and voice, had slipped in there to join him. Or had he always been a part of him, merely sleeping, until Fenoglio's world brought him to life? Sometimes, when they were taking meat or a few sacks of grain stolen from the milksop's bailiffs to one of the starving villages, women would come up to him and kiss his hand. "Oh, go and thank the Black Prince, not me," he always told them. But the prince just laughed. "Get yourself a bear," he said. "Then they'll leave you alone." A child began crying in one of the huts. A tinge of red was showing in the night sky, and Mo thought he heard hoofbeats. Horsemen. At least a dozen of them. Maybe more. How fast the ears learned to tell what sounds meant. Much faster than it took the eyes to decipher written words. The fairy scattered. Women cried out and ran to the huts where their children slept. Mo's hand drew his sword as if of its own accord. As if it had never done anything else. It was the sword he had taken from the castle of the night. The first light of dawn. Wasn't it said that they always came at first light, because they loved the red of the sky? With any luck, they'd be drunk after one of their master's endless banquets. The prince signaled to the robbers to take up their positions surrounding the village. It was only a couple of courses of flat stones, and the huts wouldn't offer much protection either. The bear was snorting and grunting, and here they came now, out of the darkness, horsemen. More than a dozen of them, with a new crest of umbra on their breasts, a basilisk on a red background. They had not, of course, been expecting to find men here. Weeping women, crying children, yes, but not men. And armed men at that. Taken aback, they reined in their horses. They were drunk. Good. That would slow them down. They didn't hesitate for long, seeing at once that they were far better armed than the ragged robbers. And they had horses. Fools. They'd die before they realized that weapons and horses weren't all that counted. "Every last one of them," Snapper whispered hoarsely to Mo. "We have to kill them all, Blue Jay. I hope your soft heart understands that. If a single man gets back to Umbra, this village will burn." Mo merely nodded, as if he didn't know. The horses neighed shrilly as the riders urged them towards the robbers, and Mo felt it again, just as he had on Mount Etta when he had killed Buster. That coldness of the blood, cold as the hoarfrost at his feet, and the only fear he felt was fear of himself. But then came the screams, the groans, the blood. His own heart beat loud and much too fast, striking and thrusting, pulling his sword out of the bodies of strangers, the blood of strangers wet on his clothes, faces distorted by hatred. Or was it fear? Fortunately, you couldn't see much under the helmets. They were so young. Smashed limbs, smashed human beings. "Careful. Watch out behind you. Kill. Fast. Not one of them must get away. Blue Jay." One of the soldiers whispered the name before Mo struck him down. Perhaps he had been thinking with his last breath of all the silver he'd get for bringing the Blue Jay's body back to Umbra. More silver than he could ever take as loot in a whole lifetime as a soldier. Mo pulled his sword out of the man's chest. They had come without their body armor. Who needed armor against women and children? How cold killing made you. Very cold. Although your own skin was burning and your blood was flowing fever hot. They did indeed kill them all. It was quiet in the huts as they threw the bodies over the precipice. Two were their own men, whose bones would now mingle with those of their enemies. There was no time to bury them. The Black Prince had a nasty cut on his shoulder. Mo bandaged it as best he could. The bear sat beside him, looking anxious. The child came out of one of the huts, the little girl who had pushed up his sleeve. From a distance, she really did look like Maggie. Maggie, Risa, he hoped they'd still be asleep when he got back. How was he going to explain all the blood if they weren't? So much blood. "Sometime, Mortimer," he thought, "the nights will overshadow the days. Nights of blood. Peaceful days. Days when Maggie showed him everything she had only been able to tell him about in that castle of night. Nymphs with scaly skins dwelling in blossom-covered pools. Footprints of giants long gone. Flowers that whispered when you touched them. Trees growing right up to the sky. Moss women who appeared between their roots as if they had peeled away from the bark. Peaceful days. Nights of blood. They did what they could to cover up the traces of the fight and left, taking the horses with them. There was a note of fear in the stammered thanks of the village women as they left. They had seen with their own eyes that their allies knew as much about killing as their enemies did.
Folks, the way this works is you put your hand up. We will call on you. Please wait for the microphone before you ask your question. And one question apiece. Who would like to start? Right here in the second row. If you'd keep your hand up, and she'll get the microphone to you.
How did you think of all the names for all the characters?
Yes, that is a very, very important task. Because in illustrations, I never show the faces of my characters. I very rarely do. So with a name, you have to see it. I have name dictionaries from all over the world. I do phone books, very helpful. And when I do a medieval setting, I look into old texts from the Middle Ages to see what kind of names they had at that time. And you are surprised, you won't know one of those names. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I do plant dictionaries, because our ancestors were very inventive when it came to the naming of flowers, and then I steal from them.
Another question. Right in the third row here, right behind her. You want to keep your hand up? Okay.
Who's your favorite character?
Ooh, that's a difficult one. It's almost like you have to choose between your children, okay? Yeah. Well, with the ink books, it's very difficult, because each time I say, I think it's Dustfinger, I think maybe it's Anolio. Oh, Eleanor. I also like Eleanor. So in these books, I really split into 100 personalities. And in a way, I'm fond of all of them. Do you have a favorite? Okay, yeah. I like Furry too. You see, that's the problem. I like them all.
Another question. Right here in the third row.
What's it like to have your book turned into a movie?
You know, you hear all these terrible reports about frustrated writers or things like that. I didn't have that experience at all. It was a wonderful and very adventurous experience to see my book turned into movies. And the best thing is when I was now in England and they showed the trailer after the readings and I've met many children who had seen it already, they all say they absolutely love it. And my publishers call me and say they love it. So they got it right in a way. Because it's difficult. You just imagine, if you read this book aloud, it takes you 18 hours. Well, how long is a movie? 2 hours. So you can imagine you have to change a lot, you have to switch things, you have to nevertheless keep the heart of the story. And as you will hopefully see when you see the movie, the cast is so brilliant, and they all loved so much to work on it. And the director fought very hard for the studio to put it exactly in the places I had imagined. So it's all shot in northern Italy, at least much of it. That I think you will get a good taste of it. And when I walked into that village they had chosen, and suddenly all the black men of Capricorns came up to me with their uniforms and their rifles, I felt like, oh my God, this is very real, okay? And then they said, Cornelia, could you sign my book? So it was. I felt like Fenolio. I surely did. I met them all. And I remember when I came to Italy, Brendan Fraser had given that had done a dinner for me. And when I walked into the house, all my characters came from all the sides. You know, there was Helen Mirren as Eleanor, and there was Eliza as Maggie, and there were Paul Bettany as Dustfinger, and of course Brendan as Mo. So that was quite a magical moment.
Another question right here in front.
For the nightmare, why not Capricorn instead of Basta?
Sorry, I didn't get that. What is with Capricorn instead of Basta?
Why didn't you have Capricorn be the nightmare instead of Basta?
Oh, that's a very good question. I never had that one before. I think that Basta, in a way, is a weaker character. So I felt that Orpheus can easily get him out of the book and get him back. And I also like to write about Basta better than to write about Capricorn. So it was also for very selfish reasons.
We will get back there. We're going to just work our way back slowly. Right here in front.
How did you come up with the names for the books?
The name for the books. With Inkheart, it was already that I thought from the beginning it's called Inkheart, and I had no idea why. I thought ink, it's of course what you write with as a writer. I used to write with a fountain pen very often, so it's very close. And then I thought Capricorn has a heart as dark as ink. So when I came to the second part, and it was about Mo doing the Book of Immortality, and you have to write 3 words into there to kill the Etherhead, I had heart, blood, and death. So you say to yourself, why is the second book then called Inkspell? Because my British publisher was scared of the word blood. And he said, Cornelia, I don't think it's a good idea for a children's book to say ink blood. And I said, well, Barry, if you think so. So they made it into Inkspell. And, of course, that is a nice double meaning of the spell and the spelling. And you cannot do that in German. So the Germans have the blood, and you have the spell.
Cornelia, what does it sound like to say each title in German?
It's Tintenherz, Tintenblut, and Tintentod.
Tintentod. Okay. This young man right here.
Oh, just forgot my question.
Gone. They sometimes do that.
We'll come back.
It will come back, yeah.
Yeah. This gal right here. Yep, you.
When does your story take place?
I think it takes place now. So I always imagined the world in which it starts to be our normal world. And, for example, the place in which Mo and Maggie live at the beginning, that's the southern border of Germany. And then they go over the border through Switzerland to Italy, whereas Eleanor lives by one of the northern Italian lakes. And then it is in Liguria. So the village of Capricorn is the north of Italy. It's a small stretch of coast between Italy and France. And when you go there, the villages look exactly like I described them, hopefully. And they feel like the Middle Ages. They're mostly from the 12th and the 13th century. And the streets are like this, so you will not get a car in there. And they still have their cattle often in the houses. So in the morning, you see all the sheep droppings on the alleyways. And when I did the Ink World, I made it look very much like northern Italy.
Right here, and then we'll start moving back. Just go right in front, Craig, past her.
What's your favorite book that you wrote?
You know, that's always the one I'm writing. So in that, I'm really faithless. Okay, I'm not very, you know, the moment I'm done with a book, off we go to the next one. And I'm writing a book called Reckless at the moment, and at the moment, that's my favorite one. Dustfinger gets really angry at the moment, but that's how it is.
And we'll keep going. Right here, fourth row.
What's it like to read your books in translations? Is there anything ever where you say, that wasn't the same in the German?
Yeah, because of course, and with the English translation, you are so lucky because this translation is like a glove over my hand. And Anthea Bell, who's a very old lady in Cambridge with 10 cats, and one of the most, she is the most renowned translator from German into English, did a brilliant, brilliant job. But sometimes you have words where there is no translation. For example, in German, you have a word for longing, which is Sehnsucht, but it also means that you're obsessed with the longing. So it has a meaning that's a slightly different from your word of longing. So how do you translate that then? Or there were other words, like, for example, in Germany, when we open a book, we say aufschlagen, which means beat it up. And that comes from the Middle Ages because the books had clasps. And the moment you wanted to open it, you had to beat them up. So in the German language, the word is still there, though nobody knows why. And I did a little story on that. So Mo explains to Maggie why it's called. And Anthea said, how can we keep the information with not having the word? So sometimes you have to do that as a translator. And with the other languages, I'm translated into 28 languages. I sometimes have no clue what they did. And sometimes you get a very thick or very thin book. And you're like, ooh, what happened there? Very scary.
We'll keep going over here on this side. Little gal with her hand up.
What's your favorite chapter in Dragon Rider?
That's very easy. That's Twi'lek. That's the homunculus. I would so love to have an homunculus like that.
And another question right here in the pink.
How'd you get the idea to write the Ink World trilogy?
That's not so easy to explain because sometimes I have one idea for a story and off I go. With this one, many things came together. First of all, since I wrote the Thief Lord, I had a scene in my mind with a girl sitting on her bed, it's raining, and she sees a stranger outside. And I always wondered, what kind of scene is that? To what story does it belong? I have no clue. Then I got letters from children saying, Cornelia, Thief Lord is fine, but there are so many boys in there. Can you please do a girl next time? Okay, so I said, I promise. Okay, next hero, girl. And then I saw fire eaters on a medieval market, and I suddenly knew who the stranger outside is. And then, of course, I'm a book eater, so I know the feeling that they are indeed alive in there, and they just want to come out. So I thought to myself, but how do they come out? If they come out of the book, they are like this. I don't want to have lots of tiny people in the story. So I thought, what about the voice? Because I believe that every story comes even more alive when you read it aloud. And nothing makes me happier than a mother or father coming to me and saying, I read the whole book aloud to my children. Yes! Okay. So that's how it all came together, and then the stories just told themselves.
Back here on our right.
Do you have it planned out how long the books are going to be, or do you just keep writing and writing and writing until you get to a good stopping point?
It's a mix of that. Well, first of all, I prepare mostly for half a year. For example, for Inkheart, I read everything on Martins, on book collectors, on fire eaters, and on the Middle Ages. Not everything. You can't read everything about the Middle Ages, but I read a lot. I read about 50 to 60 books to prepare for a book. Okay, and then when I put all this material together, like, you know, collecting it in a chest, doing ideas on my characters, on the places I want to go, because place is very important to me, then I start preparing about 20 chapters. So I do chapter 1, Mo's house. Dustwing appears, like that. And then, finally, after half a year, I say, you stop, Cornelia, you start writing now. Sit down with my computer. He's called Jack. Start writing, okay? And then mostly, after about 20 to 50 pages, they start doing their own thing. So I'm like, I thought he's sad in this chapter. Why is he so happy? Where does that come from? So they start shifting and changing my plot. So I have to all the time change my plot sheets. And then at about page 400, I start thinking of how this may end. And I never have a clue. Sometimes I have them all in prison. Sometimes I have them in the most desperate situations. And I'm like, what is going to happen? And I always think a story is like a maze. And you have to find the one way that goes through it. There is no other way. It's just the one. And if you find that one, you get the story right. And when I was done with these three, I felt I had got it right, which is a very good feeling.
Another question right in the middle here, in the gray.
What inspired you to write your books?
Which ones? I wrote more than 50.
Dragon Rider.
Oh, Dragon Rider. Okay, Dragon Rider was for very selfish reasons. First of all, I wanted to ride a dragon for about a year. And that gives you a feeling. When you're writing it, you're feeling it. On the other hand, it had a very strange beginning because a producer for movies and TV series had asked me whether he could use my very first book, which was about a dragon, as to base a series on it. And then he said, but you have to stretch it. You have to make it a little longer. And I said, you cannot make a book a little longer, okay? That's impossible, so I write a new one. And while I was writing it, I thought, I don't want this to be a series. I don't want this to be an animated series or something. So I bought my movie rights back. I did a book, and it's still a book. Sometimes that happens.
All right. Right here in the brown, I think you're wearing.
What is your favorite book?
Of all times, that's The Once and Future King by T.H. White. And there's another one very closely following, and that's The Princess Bride by William Goldman. Yeah. So they're in competition. But T.H. White is just a little bit ahead.
There's a fella in the red right behind you, Lindsay.
In the Dragon Rider, how come you named Sorrel, called Sorrel, Brownie if she likes mushrooms?
Yeah, okay. That is a very complicated story because Sorrel in German is called Sulfurfur. But how does that sound in English? Okay? So my translator says Sulfurfur. That just doesn't work, Cornelia. We have to come up with a new name for her. So we came up with Sorrel because she's so bitter sometimes. And I felt it fits. Then, how do we call her? In German, she's a goblin. And there's a word in German called Kobold, which doesn't mean it doesn't have any fur. The goblins in your tradition mostly are furless and very strange little ugly men. Okay? So I thought, that's wrong. So Anthea, my wonderful translator, found a Scottish myth about hairy creatures called brownies. So she said, why don't we call them brownies? Which in America is quite an difficult thing because you have, as far as I know, you have for sure a very good cake called brownie, and you have Girl Scouts, right, called brownies, which is utterly confusing. So they are Scottish brownies. And the mushrooms, I came up with that idea because I wanted to have her curse all the time, and I looked up all the curses in a dictionary on mushrooms. So each time she wants to really be angry, she picks a very poisonous mushroom.
Mushrooms and brownies, I'm detecting a theme. The little guy in the black right back here.
What do you think of the Inheritance series?
Of the what?
Inheritance series. Elagon, Eldest, and
Prisoner. I don't know it. That's my problem when I'm writing. I'm not allowed to read because otherwise the books totally confuse me. So sometimes they totally escape me. Do you like it? Do you think I should read them?
Yes.
Okay. I will remember.
Another question? Oh, so many. How about right on the aisle here?
How did you come up with the white woman?
Well, the white woman is actually partly my invention, but only partly. Because in English and Irish fairy tales, you have ghosts who appear when somebody is dying. So the moment you see them, you get a warning that somebody's going to die. And that's in very many fairy tales and myths. And I always loved that. But I made them almost into angels. And in my case, they're not as frightening as they are also friendly. Especially in the second and the third part, where they become the guardians of Mo. So I stole a little bit and I mixed my own thing in.
Right in front here, Julie.
How is Brendan Fraser to work with?
He was a pleasure to work with. And I have to tell you, he's even more brilliant as an audio reader than he is as an actor. We should all lock him into one of the studios and never let him out again. And let him do all the books in the world. Because I was at the studio when he recorded Dragon Rider and Inkspell, and it was the purest magic. When you listen to Inkspell, I had no idea you could read it like this. And when I listened to Dragon Rider and he came up with 27 voices, the director turned to me in the middle and said, I've never been to a performance like this, and I really have to say it's extraordinary. And on the set, of course, he was his usual sweet and very silly self.
See more hands. Okay, you've got your question.
Where did you get the idea to kill off Dustfinger in the way that you did?
Well, that was not my idea, okay? That was the story's idea. And here we come to what happens to me all the time, okay? I was in London, and I'd had a conversation with my British publisher, Barry Cunningham, who found Harry Potter, okay? He's the one who didn't send it back. And I said, Barry, how could you kill Sirius Black like that, okay? Like wiping him off the wall like a fly, okay? If I ever kill one of my characters, it will be tears and blood on the page, okay? So I go home. I have to sign 2,500 copies that morning. I'm done with that. I go to my agent's place, and I tell the whole crew about the story of Inkspell. But I was only on page 400. So they say, yeah, how does it end? I said, I have no clue. How should I know? I'm on page 400. And they're like, they got a little worried because they want to sell the book at a certain point. So I got into a cab, one of these black London taxis, and suddenly I see Dustfinger dead. And I'm like, oh, whoa, wait a moment. No way. Okay? That's my favorite character. I will not kill him off. And this picture comes again. See him, like in a movie. So I'm like, oh, okay. I have to think about this. So I come home, and I do a long walk with my dog. And I always take paper with me and a pen to write down the ideas coming when you're walking. And suddenly I think, oh, that's what he dies for Fareed. Of course. So suddenly the whole story, you know, took shape. And I suddenly knew it wanted to go there. And I also knew I would bring him back in the third part in a very different and fearless shape. And I think he's even more glorious in the third part. So that's how it happened.
Right here in the third row.
What's Reckless about?
And now you start the storyteller. That's very dangerous. Okay, I'll try my best to not say too much. Okay, it will be about two brothers. It will be the first book with no child in there. I hope you won't be offended by that, but I know that you all don't need a child in a book to love it. So the brothers are 27, 21, called Jacob and Will Reckless. And one day, they find in the office of their father, who disappeared one day, our secret door. And when you go through that door, you come into a world that feels like the 19th century mixed with the Grimm's fairy tales. So you have the cunning queen building iron bridges, but she has dwarves as her servants. You have very scary gingerbread houses. You have unicorns which look like Iceland horses. You have the ruin of Sleeping Beauty's castle. And I will take you into all the myths I grew up with because I was raised with Grimm's fairy tales. And what you also will find is creatures called the Goyle. And they live underground, they look like us, but the only difference is their skin has six colors of stone. So they look like jade or malachite or onyx. And they start conquering that world. And what they do is when they claw you, you become one of them. And sadly, Will is clawed and turns into one of them. So Jacob takes him to the fairies to rescue him. And I won't tell you whether that works or not. Don't be too sure it works. And I've done with the first draft, polishing it now for the second, and I know it will be a lot of books. It will not be just one.
Let's see. Somebody all the way in back, wave me a cap, and then we'll work back toward the middle. Okay.
Why did Firefox become...
Firefox and Gwyn. Okay.
When the guy that used to be king died, why did Firefox take his place and not Basta?
Firefox took it for a while because the Adderhead didn't really trust Basta because the Basta was a former servant of Capricorn and the Adderhead doesn't trust Capricorn. So he made the Firefox one, but the Firefox didn't last for long. And after a short while,
the Etterhead makes his brother-in-law the new ruler of Umbra, whom they call the Milksop. And you will meet him in the third book.
Anyone else back in that region? The young man right there? Go ahead, you can ask your question. Okay, while you're thinking of it, we'll go to somebody else. Another question in that area? Right here, little lady with her hand up.
Will this be your last book in the Inkworld series?
Well, for now. The thing is, you know, sometimes the books do that to me, that, and I thought, you know, as I don't tell you too much, but one of my villains escapes, and I didn't plan that at all. So when I came to the chapter where I was supposed to kill him, I looked very much forward to that. And I had thought, oh, God, I'm going to kill him, you know. I can't wait to kill that guy. It's just, will be so wonderful, okay? And it will be really cruel. He gets away. He gets away. So he escapes at the end of the chapter. And I sometimes think one day I will have to find out what he's doing on the other side of the mountains. But that's maybe. Okay?
Yeah, right over there.
At what age did you start writing?
I was very old already. I was 28. That's really old for you, you know? And I was an illustrator before that, and I got so bored by the stories they sent me that one night I decided I'd write my own story so I could do the drawings I wanted to do. That's how it began. And then I think I was 34 when I suddenly realized, oh, my God, actually you're a better writer than you are as an illustrator. And you love it much more. So always think you don't have to just know what you want to be when you're 12 or 18 or even 25. Sometimes the crooked ways are the best ways because you find out so much more about yourself.
Okay, right over here.
How did you get all the different ideas, like, in the ink world, like all the fairies and the different creatures there are?
Well, I knew when I take you in Inkspell into that other world, I have to make really sure you feel you've never been to that place before, right? So I put a lot of effort into that. So I thought, how is it? And I thought the fairies are probably like insects in that world. And then one thing after the other, suddenly the glassman showed up, and it's almost as if I walk myself into that place, and then suddenly I start seeing all the corners. I had that at the moment with Reckless. I looked into a well, and suddenly I saw a creature. I had no idea that's there. So sometimes the worlds do that to me.
Tell you what, we have so many more questions than we have time to answer. We will take two more, and then as a special treat, for those of you who haven't seen it, we'll show the trailer for the new film. So, why don't we go with this gentleman right in the middle here with his hand up. Sir, if you could continue to hold your hand up.
You've talked about reading aloud several times, and you read wonderfully. And I was wondering, can you tell me any memories of particular books or readers as you were growing up that you think of when you think of reading aloud?
My father didn't read aloud to me, for example. He took me to libraries all the time, and we came back with piles of treasure. My grandmother was a storyteller, so she told us stories all the time, and I was much closer to that for a long time and never wrote down my stories. But I do remember my favorite books as a child, which was one by Michael Ende called, let me see, Jim Button and Lucas the Steam Engine Driver, which was my very first favorite book. And then I loved the Narnia books, and I loved Tom Sawyer. I was totally obsessed with Huckleberry Finn. Yeah.
Okay, one more. How about this little lady right here in the plaid? Lindsay, right here, this gal with her hand up.
If you could live in any of your books, which one would it be?
Yeah. That is a different... At the moment, I think I would choose Reckless, but I would also be very tempted by Dragon Rider if I get the dragon.
Okay, and now we will show the trailer.
Exactly. Let's see why it works.
So,
doesn't it look great?
It does.
Yeah, not again. Folks, please join me in thanking Cornelia Funk.
Thank you very much.
And please meet us upstairs at the book signing table, just so you know how we're going to handle this. We have Cornelia can personalize one of your books, so please pick one that you would like her to sign with your name on it. The rest, she will be happy to sign anything else that you have. We'll see you up there. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.